From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the first presidential debate in 2016. Hillary Clinton was delivering an impassioned point on health care. Twitter lit up with reactions, and high on the list was the same slur. Clinton, her critics argued, sounded shrill. And maybe she should smile more. Do we tend to discuss men's voices the way we criticize women's? That's a rhetorical question. You probably know the answer to that. But now here comes the New York Times with a piece titled, A Woman, Just Not That Woman, How Sexism Plays Out on the Campaign Trail. The Times spoke to Amanda Hunter, the research director for the Barbara Lee Family Foundation, which supports women in politics. Hunter said, quote, "For 20 years, we've heard participants in our focus group say they would vote for a woman, just not that woman." End quote. And I'll read from the piece now. Quote, "In the words of her detractors during the 2016 presidential race, Hillary Clinton was abrasive and shrill. She was aloof. She was unlikable. It's not a coincidence that some of these adjectives are now bubbling up in discussions of Senators Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Kamala Harris as they campaign for the 2020 Democratic nomination. Few Americans acknowledge they would hesitate to vote for a woman for president. They don't have to, according to researchers and experts on politics and women and extensive research on double standards in campaigns. Reluctance to support female candidates is apparent in the language that voters frequently use to describe men and women running for office, in the qualities that voters say they seek, and in the perceived flaws that voters say they are willing or unwilling to overlook." End quote. The stories about the women running for president have focused this week in recent days on what music they listen to while smoking pot, on whether their staffs think they're too mean, about whether they're likable enough. Now, to state the obvious, the news media focuses on inane pablum with male candidates, too, but the New York Times piece makes the case that voters are more likely to dismiss a woman as a candidate than a man over something trivial. The sound of her voice, the clothing she wears, whether she seems ambitious, which interestingly enough is viewed as a positive attribute for male candidates. So is there a double standard? Our guests this hour are here to discuss that. Nicole Hushleray is a member of the Irondequoit Town Board, the vice chair of the Monroe County Democratic Party, and a political consultant who focuses on training women candidates. Nicole, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Robin Wilt, a member of the Brighton Town Board. Robin, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And Stephanie Townsend is a member of the Pittsford Town Board. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We reached out to a wide range of former candidates, people in office, and women from all sides of the political spectrum. We don't happen to have a Republican in office. It's not because we didn't try. I just want to say that at the outset. We wanted to bring in a lot of different perspectives here. I want to start by asking just our guests. I know you've read the piece. You've had a lot of experience in politics yourself. Nicole, how much did that piece ring true to you?
Oh, 100%. I mean, we've been, I think the last time I was on your show, we were essentially talking about this very topic, right? Sexism on the campaign trail. I think the piece really highlights the difference nowadays, right? Progress is happening a lot faster, I think, than a lot of people anticipated. And right now, with such a wide playing field of women running on the presidential level, for instance, it's going to be hard for each individual to not face their own subconscious bias towards women candidates, I think.
But is there a sense that there is progress being made, or do you look at some of those headlines just from the last few days and you think, what have we learned at all?
No, I absolutely think there is. I mean, look, a cultural shift, gender norms, those things don't happen overnight, right? I personally feel like there's been a tremendous jump since I think it was fall of 2017 I was on the show. Mm-hmm. And that's just by having more women running. I think it's going to take years, right? We have a record number of women in Congress, but we're still only just over 28%, I believe. Right. So I think a part of that is this ongoing dialogue, but also people as individuals on both sides of the aisle facing the fact that they have a subconscious bias generally towards something, if not women candidates in particular.
Okay. Stephanie, how did the piece land with you?
It definitely resonated with my experiences. I felt like the piece was spot on in how not only women candidates are viewed, but women when they are in office. Mm-hmm. I found it resonating a lot with my own experiences since being elected, not only when I was running.
Hmm. Robin?
It also resonated with me. I think that in my experience, both on the campaign trail and on the town board, you sometimes feel that there are different standards that apply to you. Things that are acceptable for males in your position are often considered grading or not normative for you in your position. And so it's a problem that you consistently combat.
What's an example?
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. Lots of things go through your mind, but I tend to dress in, I don't wear a lot of dresses. I don't wear a lot of skirts, but people will often comment on my very male shoes. I wear in Oxford, and it is a very male-looking Oxford, and people notice. People notice my dress. The fact that people comment on my dress, I think, is something that a lot of male electeds are not subject to, but people definitely notice, like, what I'm wearing, and I think that's the aesthetic standard is something that I don't think male elected officials are subjected to as much.
All right, I wanted to touch on one word right off the top here, which is ambitious. That came up in the piece, and according to some of the research done, voters feel differently about men and women when it comes to viewing ambition as a positive or a negative attribute. In mm-hmm. other words, men voters are more likely to think, well, if a man's ambitious, well, of course, you know, I mean, he wants a leadership position, et cetera. If a woman is ambitious, it looks as a little presumptuous. Why are you running for that office, et cetera? And I want to go around the table and ask how you feel about that word. Has that word sort of come up in your own campaigns, or have you heard it in the same way that it was brought about here?
Absolutely. Ambition is considered a negative, and people, is particularly is somebody who's aspired to a number of different offices, and the ambition kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, what's your level of experience? And I think the experience question is leveled more at female candidates and female electeds than it is at their male counterparts. And I think that's a problem. I think that the experience that we have is scrutinized more as to relevance. It's like, do you have this particular background, as opposed to men? I think it's just assumed that they have the requisite.
Yep.
Okay.
For me, it's not so much been about having a charge of being too ambitious. It's been a little more subtle and coded than that. What I find is that when I was running for office, and what I have seen for many women now who are stepping up now to run, is that one of the very first questions that they're asked is, do you have children?
Voters ask you that on the campaign trail?
Yes. And that's, I think, reflects perhaps a more subtle way of talking about ambition. That why are you running for something that's going to take you away from your family?
Right. Are you going to have time?
Will you have time? How old are your children is another question that's often asked. My son was 13 when I ran. So a lot of times when I would answer that question, people would say, oh, well, then he's old enough for you to be away. Whereas women who I have been mentoring over the past year to run for office, if they have younger children, that is something that even it's not just their critics, it's their supporters within mm-hmm. their own party will say, oh, your children are so young. How do you think you should wait till they're older? And so I see that as sort of a reflection of why are you pursuing a public office when you still have children at home relying on you?
Does this fall under the umbrella of something that irks me, which is that when a mother is home with children, she is parenting. When a father is, it's daddy daycare, as opposed to actually just parenting.
Yes.
Is that kind of the same kind of idea?
I think it is.
It's an insult to men, too. Yeah.
It is an insult to men.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think very much so. You want to pick it up from there? So I'm curious to know, when you train, because why don't you let our listeners know a little bit about the trainings that you have done, and then how you sort of prepare women who are going to run for office to anticipate questions like this and how you kind of navigate them.
So the Women Elect program is a good example. It started in Buffalo. I brought it here to Rochester. I'm not currently working with the program, but most of the women locally that I mentor are from the Women Elect program and now mentors themselves. And that program really focuses on talking about the thing, you know, preparing for things like that, for you know, questions you'll be asked and the different levels of sexism. But I do think we need to talk more about changing that dialogue. So maybe, you know, a man comes up to me and says, "Oh, you're wearing a sleeveless dress." That's very, which has happened to me on a number of occasions. It's, you know, sexualizing a sleeveless dress. But also, you know, the whole ambition question. Generally, it takes 7 to 8 times asking a woman to consider running for office before she will truly consider it. And that is some of the most qualified women out there. And I think a part of that is because we're culturally sort of tempering our qualifications and our confidence because it's not socially acceptable, right? There is that double standard there. Whereas a man, if he's considering running, it's almost a knee-jerk response. Why, of course I would be good for that position. So, you know, a big part of what these programs or my individual training will do is just getting good at saying, "I am this, I am good at this," not "I think I'm good at this," right? It's becoming more and more comfortable with your ability to talk about why you're qualified to be doing what you're doing and owning that. And that's difficult for a lot of women to do.
Okay. And when it comes to questions like children, you know, that women get a lot more often than men get when they're running for office, How do you sort of talk about how to prepare for the answer to that?
Sure. I mean it's truly up to the individual in terms of if they're comfortable kind of trying to move the cultural needle a little bit and playing devil's advocate.
Because everybody would probably love to say, "Oh, really? Would you ask a man that?" But I'm not sure that's a great, you know, right at the doorstep. Yeah,
there are, you know, and I've sort of had to learn this the hard way myself, but you're always better off approaching that conversation, right? Maybe especially if you care about the person who's saying something that's coming across as a little sexist. There are nice ways and diplomatic ways to approach it. For me personally, I'll just sort of laugh about it, right? Make it kind of a joke so they're a little bit more comfortable, which is, would you ask my husband that? Or would you, you know, I think there are definitely ways to do that. And I think a part of that is getting more comfortable talking about these things openly too.
And for me, I think there's in shifting that paradigm, we need to think of some of these experiences that women typically have as experiences that are relevant to office.
Yeah.
And so, have children? It's not right. It's not something that we should shy away from. Yes, I do have children, and this is how it's relevant for me as an elected official. And so, really shifting that paradigm and not viewing, you know, your experience for public service in this monochrome way.
Fair.
Yeah,
that's fair.
I've got a couple of phone calls already. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on some of your thoughts about the New York Times piece, the comments that our panelists are making this hour when it comes to how men and women are viewed differently when they run for office. Now, there are 6 women running for president officially already. I happen to know that you are going to hear a lot of names of women who are running for local office in a lot of different races here. Both major political parties, as far as I know. I happen to know a lot of women who are Democrats are going to be running. A lot of first-timers, I think. Pretty soon, you're going to start seeing names. So this is not just about what's happening on the national scene. This is about how we evaluate candidates at all levels of government. And Jessica in Rochester wants to weigh in first on the issues of moms in politics. Go ahead, Jessica.
Hi, Evan. Thanks.
Yep.
So, yeah, fascinating conversation, you guys. And I was listening, thinking about most of the young women that I know, myself included, typically work about 60 hours a week and have children. So as an elected official, it's an assumption that I'm making, but I feel like you guys probably spend, you know, a reasonable amount of time, like about that time on your job. So how is it, or I find it interesting at least, that women who are not running for office are expected to work that number of hours, and women who are, it's assumed that you would be doing a negative thing. So really, there's no right way to do it, is what it sounds like.
Yeah. Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
You want to add to that, Nicole?
I should probably let one of the other ladies, because as I'm not a mom, I'm a cat mom. But no, I think that's fair. I mean, generally, politics and campaigns are crazy, right? They're small corporations that could go belly up at any minute. They're, it's even on the town level, it takes up more of your time running than I think a lot of first-time candidates assume it will. So I think some of it is fair to, you know, to assume, well, this is going to take up a lot of your time, but would we ask a male candidate this? You know, we were kind of talking before the show, you know, when a woman is home with the kids, she's doing her job, it's her traditional duty, and when a man is home with the kids, he's, you know, it's daddy daycare time, it's babysitting, it's doing the mother a favor. And I think that's a part of the problem right there. You know, just would you be asking a male candidate this if he were on the campaign trail?
I think the other thing...
Also, I think just... Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, Jessica, go ahead, Jessica.
Just really quickly, the nature of being a mother requires a great deal of stamina. Mm-hmm. And I almost never hear it talked about that, like, you know, the benefits of having been a parent and running for office means that you already have this really intense lifestyle that you've perfected.
Sure. Absolutely. And I think that also being a parent really requires that you be able to shift quickly from one thing to the next, that you are multitasking, that you have a lot going on. And that's especially true when we're talking about municipal and county politics, because these are not full-time jobs. As a town board member, as a county legislator, they are not full-time. And so it's a mess. So I work full time. I then do my politics and public service in addition to that full time job, in addition to my family. And it is a lot to juggle. And I love the word, Jessica, you used of stamina. Mm. It does take a lot of stamina. It takes a lot of organizational skills. It takes a whole lot of different skills to be able to manage that. But I think that's one reason, too, that at the municipal and county level, that sometimes women are questioned even more about leaving their family or not leaving the time away from their children, is because it is not a full-time job. So you know that you're doing it on top of something else.
Okay, Robin?
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And I think that one of the things that I've encountered is that women on the campaign trail tend to practice a lot less self-care. And I think this is documented in research that self-care among women candidates is less than that of among male candidates. And it's because I think we're expected to carry out those traditional roles in addition to our campaigning. And really, you know, it's a societal issue. Why shouldn't your spouse be expected to support you in the same way that you would support him if you were running or if you would support? I think that we need to stop with these gender dynamics and really, and that at the base of that question is, you know, a gender dynamic. It's like you should be doing this as opposed to what you're doing.
Well, on the subject of how sort of women view the role of helping combat double standards, John in Rochester has a question for our guest. Go ahead, John.
Hi, thank you. I completely agree that men, the vast majority, are responsible for kind of this double standard continuing and being enforced. But the last couple of years has shown me, kind of to my surprise, in speaking to women that I know that were my friends, there are a lot of women that seem to be okay with these double standards existing and even like them, and feel that they want them to continue in some way, either because they feel comfortable living within those double standards. You know, they voted for President Trump because it really didn't bother them the way things were, the things that he said. And I'm curious to get everyone's opinion about just the large number of women, based on the number that voted for the president, still continues to support him. What is it about these double standards that they feel comfortable operating under, and why is it so threatening for them to think that this kind of thing would disappear?
Thanks, John. That's a fair question. And I'm, as we get farther away from the 2016 election, I'm not remembering all of the demo breakdowns, but Trump won white women pretty comfortably, I think.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so... You want to answer some of what John's asking about, Stephanie?
Well, yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, John, that this is not just how do men perceive women. It's also how women perceive women. And that's something that definitely happens just as much. For myself, one of the points in the New York Times article that really resonated with me was about women's tone. And that's something that I've been criticized for by women, perhaps more often than men, or at least the women are willing to tell me their criticism. But yes, it's not only about how men perceive women. Why that is, you know, we are all raised in that same, the same social influences. So yes, right. Women hold these biases against other women as well.
Okay, Robin?
Absolutely. That's what I was talking about. These shifts that we need in societal norms where, you know, we'd have these gender dynamics that we need to constantly combat.
Yeah. Okay, Nicole?
I'm gonna say something a little extreme. If someone has Stockholm syndrome, right? They've experienced some abuse over time, and they end up liking their abuser. And I know that's a very extreme example. I'm speaking to that. This isn't a black or white, right or wrong, women versus men issue, right? When we, to Robin's point, when we're talking about culture, and something that's really existed since the beginning of time, some of these women might not have that awareness, right? I can personally speak to that in that I've been a longtime Democrat, but I think before the 2016 elections, there were little things, little subtle things that I experienced in my day-to-day that it was just a part of life, right? Whether it was a man commenting on my weight or my outfit, right? Or being called sweetheart or honey by even men the same age as me, they weren't things that triggered a red light until I started to get my own awareness on the issue.
Yeah, that's come up in the past on this program. The question of just how you navigate the conversation when usually a man, not always, but usually a man, often an older man, not always, will refer to women as sweetheart, honey,
kiddo.
Yeah. And
my favorite.
Right here in the studio, sometime in the last year, a very prominent member in politics, who I will not name, used that term with women in the office here. And I thought, whoa, it felt demeaning. Do you call it out when you hear it?
I'm doing it more and more. There are some people who aren't ready to hear some of this stuff and get a little defensive. And I think it's harder to sort of do that with the higher up someone is in leadership, right? Because you're worried about what the repercussions might be. But I think, again, there are nice ways to approach the subject. And if these people are that important to us and we think they're such great leaders, we should want them to be better.
Interestingly enough, what you're saying is you kind of have to tone police yourself as you go about it, just because of how fragile people can be in being criticized.
Right.
But more and more you're trying to do that. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Stephanie?
I think too, for me, that some of the challenge in challenging people about this is that they think that I'm challenging them because I was offended. Or because I was uncomfortable. Mm. Oftentimes I'm not. It's simply, it's not appropriate. Where, you know, I have experienced that is that sort of paternalism sometimes. That I'm like, you know, if my grandfather said that to me, it would be perfectly appropriate. But it's not appropriate to say it to me as an elected official. I worked, especially when it's coming from other elected officials who are my colleagues, and I know we have a genuine respect for each other. But it's to call them out sometimes, then it's, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend you. Well, I wasn't offended. Right. It's simply not appropriate.
Right.
Robin?
Yeah, I think we recognize that those are terms of endearment, so that makes it harder to combat in some cases. But just because it is considered a positive way to refer to someone doesn't mean that the impact is positive. And I think we really need to think about impact as opposed to intent.
Right.
Well, I want to recommend for listeners to listen to a recent podcast with the guest on the podcast was Kate Mann, who is a writer and philosopher at Cornell. She's the author of Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. She was a guest on Ezra Klein's podcast recently, and part of what she was kind of trying to educate Ezra about and help him see was that when we talk about misogyny, Kate Mann says, from her professional perspective and her research perspective, people often think of when we think about racism, well, I don't use racist language. I don't tell racist jokes. I don't think of myself as saying misogynistic things or putting women down. But she said, think about being in a structure of misogyny. Mm-hmm. Whereas, why do you think about covering the campaign the way you are? Well, you may not be a misogynist yourself, but you're in a system that has sort of preserved some of these ideas that that women are viewed different when it comes to likability, when it comes to ambition, et cetera. And that could impact all of us, whether we know it or not, when the system is kind of etched in place. And I'm not doing justice to Kate Mann's much more nuanced, interesting book and argument. But if you listen to the podcast she did recently with Ezra Klein on The Ezra Klein Show, I at least think that's some good food for thought. You're nodding over there, Robin.
Yeah. And these are some of the things that I think that we can combat in policy. One of the first things that I addressed when I was on the town board was the use of gender-neutral language. And it's not because I think people are offended at being called councilwoman. I just think it's more appropriate if we're all colleagues and we're all in the same position that we all be referred to in the same manner. And this... And this also sends a message that we are all on the same level. There is no hierarchy, you know, especially when you're the only, quote unquote, councilwoman. Then I think that it's very easy to take that message. And it's just kind of in the ether, something that we breathe in every day. And so we have to look at our processes sometimes and say, are we being equitable?
Okay. Stephanie, Nicole, what do you make of the idea that maybe it's systemically, we all get kind of caught up in saying, well, I'm not, you know, sexist or misogynist right. or racist, but systemically, if we're existing within those structures, we may have, you know, it may rub off in certain ways, so to speak.
Absolutely. I think that it is largely a systemic issue, and that's also what makes it very hard for people to see or for people to understand why it matters so much.
Right.
Because those systems affect so many, many things that we do in our society. And it really permeates how the opportunities that are there and are not there, how people are responded to. It permeates everything in our society. And that's a much harder thing to grasp with and to just even accept.
Because it's so much bigger than us.
It's so much bigger than mm-hmm. just who's a, you know, a good guy and who's not.
Yep. Yeah. No, I love Kate Mann's approach on the podcast. It, as you're saying that, it was reminding me of, Tamara Burke, the founder of the Me Too movement. Stephanie, I saw her speak in Binghamton last year, and one thing she, you know, really eloquently said was, you know, you've got rape and sexual assault way down here on one end of the spectrum, right, a cultural spectrum, and way down on the other end, you have the way you talk to women, whether it's, you know, calling them kiddo or sweetheart or addressing the way they dress, for instance, and that seems like a very drastic thing to say, but no, that's what culture is, right? That you've got the worst of the worst on one end of the spectrum and the subtle hints shifting towards these bad behaviors. And I think it's only the responsible thing to do to kind of figure out where on that spectrum or in the cultural norms we fit and where we can impact change.
Well, I want to ask listeners directly, do you who... I guess I can't ask you if you would admit that you wouldn't vote for a woman, because the whole point of the Times piece is everyone says, yes, I would, just not that one or not that one. But have you thought about that? Have your views changed? Are you concerned about sexism on the campaign trail at local levels, at the national level, as we look at the presidential campaign? Call the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Our guest for the hour, you just heard Nicole Hushler-Ray, who is the vice chair of the Monroe County Democratic Party. She's a member of the Irondequoit Town Board and a political consultant who focuses on training women candidates. Robin Wilt, a member of the Brighton Town Board. Stephanie Townsend, member of the Pittsford Town Board. In our second half hour, we'll get some of your feedback here, and we're going to talk about the question of toughness, different standards for men and women, what is viewed as acceptable, what is viewed as sort of a baseline, and some other stereotypes. The piece that sparked the conversation comes from the New York Times. It's titled, A Woman, Just Not That Woman, How Sexism Plays Out on the Trail. We've posted it on our various platforms if you want to check it out. We'll come back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, we go inside the world of slam poetry, the remarkable craft inside the back rooms where teams are creating slam poetry for a national competition. It's part of a new documentary called Don't Be Nice. It's presented as part of the Black Cinema Series at the Little Theater this weekend. The filmmaker and local slam poets join us next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guests during our brief break, we're just discussing how occasionally women, even in elected office, not just on the campaign trail, not just in a regular, I would say regular, in a non-political office space, are sort of treated this way. But sometimes, whether we men realize it or not, it's like, well, Stephanie, you're the woman in the office, so can you do what? What do they ask you to do?
Well, for me, there have been many occasions where it is sort of performing some of those secretarial roles or needing to be the time manager for the man. So I am, have frequently when if I'm in political strategy meetings or things like that, it's, we're going to send a memo. Well, Stephanie, would you draft that memo? I'll look at it. One thing that I encounter a lot that I really do not believe that my male colleagues encounter is people asking me, so where is so-and-so tonight? Is he going to be at this meeting? As if I am the timekeeper for all of my colleagues' schedules. But I truly do not believe, and have actually asked about this and gotten feedback, that my male colleagues are never asked about my schedule.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, Robin?
Yeah, I think, again, just assuming that you're going to assume some of those roles that are traditionally gendered as females, those secretarial roles, being the scribe in meetings, I'm always asked to take notes at the meeting. And that's, again, that's not just in my role as a member of town board. It's more in my role as a member of any board. and just assuming that I'm going to be managing people's time. Yeah, I'm going to be the mother in the room.
Nicole?
A couple examples came to mind. I was actually recently talking to a peer on another town board elsewhere and on how we as women aren't necessarily we don't come to mind with our colleagues in terms of some of the committees we get put on. So maybe it's, we're building a new this. Let's automatically put the men on this because it's a new building, right? And men like construction, whatever, And that, I think that's definitely something I've experienced. But on wearing a different hat, the last time I served as a campaign manager, meeting a major donor walked up to me and said, I didn't realize you were the campaign manager. I thought you were just another pretty face here to, actually said that.
Wow.
So, I mean, these issues exist on both sides of the aisle, obviously, and I don't think this is a bad person for saying that. It's just, again, it's part of the culture. And instead of, kind of combating it in a sort of you're sexist kind of way, just find ways to subtly bring this up in conversation or correct them. Right? No, I'm not offended by that, but somebody else might be. Like, I'm looking out for you by saying this.
And so maybe I'll take this time to say public service announcement for anyone emailing the connections line there. Megan Mack and I are co-equals on this program. I host the show more often, but we are co-equals. She does not keep my calendar. She does not make, everybody in this office makes coffee. You can ask me to make coffee if you're on the show. That's fine. But she's not a designated coffee maker, coffee runner, or schedule keeper, or secretary. We're co-equals on the show. So anyway,
great.
Unrelated, sort of. But anyway, let me get back to your phone calls. Mayor Julie Dommert to Fairport is on the line with us.
Hi, Julie.
Hi, Julie. Go ahead.
Ladies.
Hi, Julie.
I think this is such a valid conversation. I was on the trail last year, and I can cite experiences having a neighborhood coffee where the topic was, how will you handle HR responsibilities as mayor? And how will you handle difficult conversations? And I believe it was spoken in a very confident way. The response of the person who hosted the coffee got back from attendees the next day is, man, she was a bit aggressive, wasn't she? And the hostess turned the question back on them and said, you know, do you think she was aggressive if she was a man? Would that response that you got last night have made you have that comment if this was a man? And they're like, well, no, probably not. So many times we have to, like, look at how we come across people when we talk to them. Are they going to put that predisposition that if you're a woman and you talk in a confident manner about how you would handle a situation, that someone's going to see you as coming across as aggressive or using that word, shrill? It's out there today. I'm so excited that there are many women candidates running for office in 2020 for president, because I think it starts to normalize, instead of making it, oh, look, there's a woman running, would you hire one of those women? It starts to make it more normalized that there are candidates of color, there are candidates who are women, and people start to see that as the norm, not the exception.
Absolutely.
Julie, thank you for the phone call. You want to... response, Stephanie, I see you jumping in.
Right. Well, as Julie was talking, it made me think of one thing from the New York Times article where they were talking about actual research that's been done that shows that the more that women candidates demonstrate leadership abilities, their likability rating goes down. And I think that's exactly what Julie is describing there with that example. And it's something that I know I have experienced as well, and I see heads nodding here around the table, that when you do act in those ways, just as a male candidate or elected official would, that sometimes even people will agree that, oh, I'm glad, yeah, you're doing the right thing. I just wish you could do it in a nicer way.
Yeah. Well, and to put a fine point on what the research says, because it's the problem sort of blooms from there, because what Stephanie's talking about is true. The women's likability may come down if they are perceived acting in a certain way that maybe men wouldn't be questioned for. And then if a woman's likability goes south with voters, they basically cannot recover. Let me read from the New York Times story. Quote, researcher Amanda Hunter says, "We know that voters will not support a woman that they do not like, even if they believe that woman is qualified. But they will vote for a man they do not like if they believe he is qualified. In 2016, both Mrs. Clinton and Mr. Trump had poor favorability ratings among voters who said they viewed both candidates negatively. Trump won by 20 points." Mm-hmm. So it is a death knell for women running if people don't like them, but they're less likely to like them if they're viewed as too aggressive, too ambitious, and words that men usually don't experience. I don't know what you do with that.
Right.
You have to train women to run for office. That is a big challenge, I would think, Nicole.
Well, and also because we're talking about two very huge streams of progress that need to be happening at the same time. The first half is just the general stuff you need to know as a first-time candidate. And then you add the layer of, and these are the added things you'll experience as a woman. And then on top of that, you know, especially if this person wants to be a leader, you know, you have to sort of be the tip of the spear on changing this, right? So it's so much to try and get across in a short span of time. But no, I think that's probably the worst part of all of this, right, is knowing that even for their sins, right? We were talking about this before the show started. Even for their sins, men can often be forgiven. Oh, well, I like him. He's actually a good guy. He did this for my nephew. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, we used to have coffee with him once a month, and I don't care what he did. And to be honest, I know very Democrat, Republican alike, people that I've respected for many years kind of playing into that. And one of the worst examples I've heard is, you know, we all know what a horrible dude Eric Schneiderman turned out to be. And there are people in Democratic politics in the state of New York that afterwards were like, oh, you know what, I just really like him. And it wasn't just a, oh, darn, now he's gone. It's, I still like him, and we're probably going to stay friends. so the fact that that likability or a lack thereof for women is a death blow early on before any actual, for lack of a better word, sin is committed, right? It shows what a huge problem that actually is.
Robin,
yeah.
Will?
Oh, yeah. And I think that there are a lot of tropes out there, like the angry black woman trope. And if you are passionate about an issue, or if you demonstrate a degree of competence or leadership, then people judge you negatively for that because those tropes exist. And then at the same time, if you're trying to not come across in that manner, if you're trying to kind of balance for that angry black woman trope, then are you considered too soft?
Right. And so, you can't be your authentic self.
Right, exactly. You can't be your authentic self. So on the one hand, you're like, I don't want to come across as too aggressive, too ambitious, too angry. But then if you come across as very even-keeled or even not too forward, then people think that, can you really stand up to those guys in this rough-and-tumble world of politics? So it's one of those damned if you do, damned if you don't scenarios again.
Mm. Amanda on the phone next. Go ahead, Amanda.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say all these things are really true. I completely agree with everyone who's saying all these horrible things, but there is a little silver lining that I see, which is that there are some kind of ways in which women can really start to run as women and then embrace some of these things and use them as strengths. Just to give an example, I think that women politicians in particular tend to be called by their first name, whereas maybe people in general, women tend to be called by their first name, whereas men tend to be called by their last name. And there's research that shows that kind of the more familiar a politician can be, the more they're called by their first name, the more popular they are. And so I think the more that women start to just embrace being women and start, running as women unabashedly.
Yes.
We might, that's a silver lining in the scope of all this bad stuff, but I think it's nice to keep in mind. That's all I wanted
totally
to say.
Right.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Amanda. Thanks for the phone call. Thoughts there?
I totally agree with that. I really believe this has been my own experience. It's what I tell other candidates, male and female alike, is that you have to be true to who you are. You are asking voters to trust you to make good decisions that they can't even anticipate what will come up while you're in office. And so I really say it's important to run to yourself and then let the voters decide if that's who they want. But you can't be trying to accommodate all of these different, well, I should do this or that, more of this, less of that. You really have to be true to who you are. That's not to say to be arrogant. I mean, every time that I get feedback about my tone or, about how I come across, I always stop and I consider that. I take that in. I think about where it's coming from. I think about how it is in relationship to other feedback I've gotten. There's a humility that I actually bring to those situations, to see, is there something I need to do differently? But in the end, you have to be true to who you are.
To Amanda's point, Teresa emailed the program saying that when women are, and here's an example, Senator Kamala Harris recently has been getting a lot of sort of social media blowback for comments she made about when she smoked pot, what music was she listening to, was it out at the time, are you being authentic? And Teresa, to Amanda's point, says the following. Says, women in politics have to be so careful not to do so many things. Raise her voice for fear of being called shrill, show anger or frustration for being called a bitch, dress in any manner that may call attention to the fact that she's a woman, to name a few. And because of all this caution, women can come across as not genuine or not sincere, and well, of course not. Women are not allowed to be themselves. That is from Teresa.
It's a balancing act. I think Amanda's. I think they're both spot on, but I agree with Amanda. I think that is a part of the solution as well, not just talking about these things, but balancing a preparedness and political savviness with who was my authentic self, right? And I think that's something we're seeing more and more since the 2016 elections, is we know that voters vote for a person, right? A person they feel like they can connect to and likability. What, am I getting the real deal? And that's the kind of what you've heard again and again from Trump is, well, he might say some horrible things, but at least he's speaking his truth, right? And I think, you know, for women, it's being comfortable with being sort of the first to do this, right? We see Ocasio Cortez, you know, getting criticized for dancing, and this sort of just not held back version of themselves, right? Or acknowledging the fact that women curse, right? I think it's just being brave to sort of take those first steps, and that sort of brings out the conversation widespread.
Was it Rashida Tlaib? Yeah, the cursing.
Yeah.
We've never heard.
Clutching your pearls.
Let me get Kay in Gates on the phone next. Go ahead, Kay.
Hey, I just thought one way we could point out the absurdity of the differences between the way men and women are perceived on the campaign trail is to start asking the same questions of men that we ask of women. So when you go to a meeting, or maybe a reporter can ask, hey, where did you buy your shoes, candidate Joe? Or what's up with your hairstyle? Or, you know, how did you decide on that outfit? And when candidate Joe says, oh, my wife picked it out, then we should say, well, if you can't dress yourself, how can we trust you to hold public office? You know, it's nothing like showing the absurdity to bring the absurd to light. And I think, this is sort of off topic a little bit, but by way of example, I have heard now men say the following. When you look at the women's national soccer team that's won 3 World Cups and see that they're paid a mere fraction of what the men's national soccer team, who can't even make the tournament, is paid, the gender pay disparity issue becomes crystal clear. So put that picture on the wall, put those two teams together, and then start asking questions about their shoes. Because, you know, really? Why do they wear heels, and why aren't they wearing heels?
Kay, thank you for the phone call. So at first I'm hearing Kate's call, and as a journalist I'm going, oh, I hear the spirit of the call, but I don't want to be asking anyone questions about what they're wearing or what their hairstyle is. I just don't want to. But I think Kay is trying to make an absurd point. She's saying, do it for a little while to men, and then everyone will see how stupid this is, and we can all move on.
Sure.
And maybe there's something to
that. There's a lot of different ways to bring something into awareness, and I'm sure there are instances where that could work, especially if we're trying to make something a little ha-ha funny to make people more comfortable with talking about it or less defensive when they're approached about it.
Where was it? Australia, where the morning news anchors, the man wore the same suit every day for a year. No one said a thing, but the woman had plenty of comments on the clothing she was wearing.
Wild stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Kay, good thought experiment there.
Made me laugh.
Jerry in Rochester. Got to be tight. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hi. I want to make a comment, and then you could speak on it after I finish. I think today everybody is too thin-skinned in politics and society in general. There's a double standard on things. It's okay if Uncle Harry calls a girl cutie as she's growing up, or Cokie, or Poppy throughout her life. And I'm sure there's many more examples of that. If a guy dresses like Pee Wee Herman, he's going to get called out. Nothing intentional. If he wears a sleeveless T-shirt, somebody might rag on him and say, you got a wife beater shirt on, or you got a Guido shirt on.
I'm not exactly sure the point you're trying to make here. Maybe what I hear from Jerry, and unfortunately we're out of time there, Jerry, is that there's times where it's appropriate to ask questions. Okay, if someone wears, I'm sure there's an outfit that anybody could wear that would probably merit a question. Sure. I'm not saying there's never a time. But, I mean, is there anything just more of a waste of time when we analyze how many pantsuits Hillary Clinton wore, or what color, or what? It is a waste of time, and it demeans somebody in a different way here is the point.
Well, frequency and threshold matter in this instance. He's talking about, like, potentially, you know, wearing an absurd outfit versus women are, their outfits are talked about every single day, or I could just be wearing a sleeveless dress, right? And also, you know, It's maybe Pee Wee Herman gets asked about his suit once a year, but again, we're it's something that we experience every single day.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just feel like let's leave the fashion commentary to Robin Given in the Washington Post. And even then, there are times where she writes about political fashion, and I'm a little uncomfortable. But pretty much, I'm just leave it there. Some brief final thoughts here. Are you more optimistic that you're seeing a lot more women running? And you've worked with a lot of them. Are you optimistic, though, that the culture is changing? Earlier in the program, you said you do see some change.
I am optimistic because I'm having a lot of conversations like this, a lot of public conversations. And women are not operating in politics as islands anymore. We're talking about this stuff. We're working together and sort of banding together to, change the conversation.
Okay. Robin, I know you've run multiple campaigns. Are you feeling more any difference or change that you've seen?
I'm definitely feeling more optimistic. I think that as people see women in this role more and more, women get to be judged on an individual basis and not as a group.
Okay. Final thoughts, Stephanie?
Yeah, I am optimistic, and I think especially in looking at the Democratic presidential primary right now, with so many women running, you can't get away with saying, not that woman.
Yep.
Because if you say that about all six women, then it's going to be clear that there is a gender bias there. So I think we're going to see some shift happening even in this next election cycle.
Absolutely.
There were themes we didn't even get to, and there's a lot more to talk about on these and related themes. I want to thank our guests, Stephanie Townsend, member of the Pittsford Town Board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Robin Wild, member of the Brighton Town Board.
You're nice very welcome.
Thank you. And our thanks to Nicole Hushler-Ray, who's with the Irondequoit Town Board and vice chair of the Monroe County Democratic Party. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.